Our third speaker will be speaking on the enigmatic David, how do we pronounce his name?
Eisenson.
Okay. And it will be presented by Ben Young. And we have here, Ben Young is an independent researcher and archivist in black music, specializing in the jazz avant-garde of the 1960s. His work is, as producer at Triple Point Records, is the latest chapter of a 20-year history in reissue production. For 6 years, he has been a staff lecturer at Lincoln Center's Swing University in New York. Mr. Young's forthcoming work is a biodiscography of pianist Cecil Taylor. Thank you.
Friends, we're going to get this right or die trying. It'll take just a minute. I will say while queuing this up, among the many things that are good feelings for me, as I'm sure they are for you about being in Pittsburgh, there's a lot of jazz history that belongs to this place. And it is extremely gratifying to me to see that for all the really, really important people who have contributed to the curvature of the music who come from Pittsburgh, there's a nice, healthy amount of attention being paid to Errol Garner and to Mary Lou Williams, to Roy Eldridge, to Earl Hines, to Art Blakey within the context of this conference. And I'm going to ignore all of them and tell you about somebody who is not exactly of that stature. And I'll say it straight up. This man is deserving of attention. He's remarkable enough to merit the 15 minutes of fame that he's going to get today, but he's not a household name and shouldn't be. And it would be wrong for me to say he should be a household name, but he is a person who owns a really impressive story and a very distinctive audio signature. So it'd be my pleasure to introduce you to David Eisenson is his name. It used to be easier. His family did an Ellis Island hypercorrection back to I-Z-E-N-S-O-N, but then Eisenson's generation and his family said, no, we'll go back to how it used to was with two Z's in it, but that's our man. Mr. Eisenson is a bass player. His story starts here in Pittsburgh, and I'm going to tell you the capsule story of his career, and we'll talk a little bit about the collection that appends to it. And most of the story actually belongs to his music making outside of this place, but there's some interesting threads that come from here. Eisenson is part of the world of what we'll call the avant-garde in jazz, the free jazz spectrum that truthfully doesn't get a whole lot of love from ARSC people, so it's good to be on this platform doing this stuff as well. He is an improvising musician who is most well-known by way of his association with a real giant in that field, Ornette Coleman, the alto saxophonist and composer, who would be the sort of, if we had a king in free jazz, he would be the king of free. Eisenson's career entails, simply put, that he is a virtuoso string player who draws on a multifarious background and sort of spins the threads of where he came from into the abstract expressionism of free jazz within Ornette Coleman's music. He went on beyond Ornette Coleman to make a music of his own, at least to some degree as a leader in New York, and by way of his tendency, like some musicians have, and like a lot of people in the room have, to document what it is that we do, he becomes sort of the assembling point for a whole lot of music of his time. A little bit of Pittsburgh, a lot of the period of working with Ornette Coleman, and then a fair amount of just gathering through his participation in the New York, let's call it free music scene of the 60s into the 70s, a lot of an underground that is rather important within this limited sector, the sort of teapot of free jazz. Eisenson is remarkable partly because I'm used to speaking about this guy with jazz audiences, but I think you guys will understand. In jazz music, most people who play the double bass, the upright acoustic bass, play pizzicato, plucking the instrument. And that is the way it is. There are some jazz bass players who are also capable at playing with a bow. Most are not that great and sort of play to their strength instead and to where the music is going of playing pizzicato. Alternatively, most classical players are taught bow specialties, and most of the work that they'll end up doing in symphony work and in chamber work and so on is playing with the bow. And this guy, Dave Eisenson, is remarkable because he comes from a classical background and has bowing, playing arco, as the strong suit in what he does. And by the time he steps through the threshold into jazz music, it's significant because he has a whole other presence or brings a different set of resources to that whole environment. We're going to hear just a couple of examples as we go through this today of what that sound is like. But we'll sort of start you off with the David Eisenson story, which actually kicks off, I guess, just a few miles from here. I haven't yet visited Trent Street, but where the hill meets Polish Hill, there's an interesting sector that the 1940 census, which is, I'm sure, quite illegible to you here, tells us is the meeting point for a couple of different waves of immigration. The Great Migration brings black Americans from Florida, Mississippi, Alabama, who say they've been living there for 5 and 10 years and 20 years as the work opportunities are scaling up in the first part of the 20th century. And they're sitting, as this will tell you, on the same block in the same neighborhoods with a different wave of immigrants who come by way of Ellis Island and migrated out farther to the west following industrial work as well. And Eisenson belongs to the latter. He's a Jewish American of Russian parentage, and he's part of this set of people who will say, we come from, like his parents came from, Russia or Lithuania or Austria and a number of other places to end up on this one sort of block. Eisenson is not from a musical family in any particular way. Did I just do that? But he tells us late in life, he wanted to be an opera singer, realized he didn't have a voice, so that wasn't going to work. There was room for him to study cantorial traditions within Judaism, and he does get to do some of that as a kid. And as you spin through our musical examples today, you'll understand exactly how that factors into the singing projection that Eisenson wants to put into how he plays the instrument. What he does do is take violin lessons. He'll be the first musician, as the eldest one in his family, to study any in music in any formal way. And he's a violinist in high school. He gets drafted in to go to service in the military in the time of the Korean War at the top of the 1950s. And thankfully, to avoid having to carry a rifle, was able to talk himself into playing the bass, which they need a lot more of in army bands than they do violins. And this is the big switch. David Eisenson becomes a bass player. By the time he exits the army, he's not necessarily a musical professional, spends a couple of years trying to be, to uphold the family tradition and sell luggage for his father's business downtown here. That wasn't going to work. And there was room for David Eisenson to indulge the wish to become a professional musician, and that actually is going to be the ticket out of Pittsburgh to New York. He goes to the Manhattan School of Music for the years that closed the 1950s. And to catch you up on it, here's this guy who comes from cantor singing as one background, violin playing as another background, a chance in the Army to do intensive studies on the bass, and a chance at the Manhattan School of Music to really dig into the classical literature. And he also has some kind of jazz spark, likely from the neighborhood, likely from Pittsburgh surroundings. And I'll point out, the last time we'll visit Pittsburgh here, this gentleman who's mentioned on the last line, Charles Bell, is a Pittsburgh pianist who is not of any fantastic distinction, let's say. He was a serious Pittsburgh player, and somebody's gonna get bristled when I say that, but. In 1965, there was a rather well-traveled piano summit here that brought Errol Garner together with Duke Ellington, with Earl Hines. And Charles Bell's name to be on that list as the sort of local entry in this piano thing was enough of a distinction to tell you he was serious, if not world class. Mr. Bell is now deceased for a couple of years. But this would be the jazz credential in Pittsburgh for David Eisenson that's represented at least a little bit in his collection of Eisenson on bass, Charles Bell playing piano, and a drummer named Alan Blairman, who is the surviving member of that group and now lives in Europe. So David Eisenson, the top of the 60s, is going to be up and out and step into a sort of other threshold that he was introduced to at the Manhattan School of Music, which is, to put it simply, is 20th century classical music. This spread relates to an episode in 1962 that is sort of an electroacoustic performance phenomenon, and the way we have this, the picture preserved that you see is an ad for AR speakers, which are on the stage as the thing that's going to project a four-track tape against which Mr. Eisenson will be improvising on stage. So he and the speakers are the performers in a piece of music written by the fellow who's pictured on the left there, Joe Schiani. This is the place where David Eisenson's going to get a first anchoring into a real improvising capacity as a performer, but I want to let you in on one tiny thing that comes from Eisenson's tape collection, which is our first track on the CD. It's just a small clip, and it, unfortunately, Eisenson steps away from the microphone a little bit to say this, but tells us a little bit about how it was that in his mind, at least, and in his activity, classical tradition in his background met up with the will toward improvisation. This is track one, Michael.
I remember one time I was going preparing for a recital and I was going to play the Vivaldi A minor violin piece. I was really going to show off that day, you see. And I was practicing it and I noticed the feeling, da 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 da, you know, it was a flow like that, you know. And that feeling kept going. I put the piece, the bass down, and I maybe came back that night. And I kept getting that feeling, you know. And I kept thinking about that feeling, and then I stopped playing those notes, but played other notes. But then I didn't get the feeling, but then I had to find that feeling, you know, and that's how I got hooked.
In case you can't hear that last line, he says, that's how I got hooked. In other words, that he's sort of following this this impulse toward that dimension of creativity. That's going to be another major factor that goes into the swirl for David Eisenson. I didn't describe this, but what I'm going to do is walk through a narrative history of where David Eisenson was making these sounds, and then we'll do a sort of another brief walkthrough of what the materials are that comprise his collection. About 270 pieces of mostly reel-to-reel tape, a little bit of film and videotape, covering the meaty part of his career, and really it kicks off or gets rolling at the top of the 60s where we're talking into right now. These are the same fellows having found a way to do something that wasn't just this electroacoustic music, but a piano and bass improvisation that did appear by 1964 and 5 at Slug Saloon, and they actually made a record that from the fall of 63 that shows up in 1965. But this is why we're here. This is the reason that anybody is still talking about David Eisenson, is exactly this moment that Eisenson in New York in 1960 was ready, to, it seems, to sort of make a bet that he could get a foothold into some sort of musical environment that would want him. He actually knocked on the door of John Coltrane and said, here's what I do. Coltrane in 1960 said, that's impressive, but that's not what I'm going to do, so I don't need you. This partnership, so to speak, with Ornette Coleman comes from Eisenson calling up Ornette Coleman to say, I'd like to come down and sit in with your band. And Ornette Coleman, thankfully, is of such an open mind that his answer, sight unseen, without knowing anything else about this fellow, was, yes, come on down and show us what you do. And we get this sort of flint and steel situation where Ornette Coleman was leaving the band sound that had established his creativity, a four-piece group with trumpet, bass, and drums, liquidating that, losing most of the players, and at precisely this moment, David Eisenson shows up with the ability to interpolate this Arco sound into what was an increasingly fluid and easily changing or easily morphing projection of Ornette Coleman's music. There's only so much you want to say about that before hearing it. So let's hear our example two, a few minutes of Coleman in the new trio that has David Isenson on bass and a drummer named Charles Moffett playing as a trio and then fading out into, or rather fading as it naturally did into in the performance, into a solo by David Isenson. Ornette Coleman, for a couple of cycles of his creative development already, had been working to bring the bass instrument out of the rhythm section, that's the back line of the band, up into what you actually see here, which is standing at the front of the stage. Even when there were a two horn plus bass combination, having the bass player be a sort of equal partner. And this is the arrival of David Isenson into Ornette Coleman's concept made it pretty easy to understand things that way, especially in this trio. We've been hearing examples from this engagement at the place that is effectively the village vanguard of Stockholm, I guess, called the Golden Circle or Gyllene Cirkeln. That lecture that Isenson gave a minute ago was something done at a music school on the night after the performance that you just heard from this situation. Comes a time when Ornette Coleman decided he wanted to assemble a band with two bass players, which was fantastic for listening audiences, and it was not a happy circumstance for either of the bass players to play second fiddle, if you will, in this band. So that was only going to last a minute, and Isenson exited the group in 1967 after 5 years as the sort of cornerstone player in Coleman's world. and starts off on at least a brief journey of doing some special things that are his own things. We'll hear in a minute from a quintet that he assembled that's pictured not here, but here on one of Eisenson's own recordings of the group. He had a further idea as a string-minded person to say, well, what if I had a band that was just four bass players and we let ourselves be creative among each other? And there's a lot of good output from that, even though there wasn't going to be a performance, as far as I know, or certainly a recording of that group called Bass Revolution. There is a side of David Eisenson that matches up with his biography, as we'll follow into the 70s in a minute, where in a way that's also not part of his preserved legacy in print, but is part of his tape collection, he's writing simple songs. He's writing kids' songs, as many of us do, or sort of indulging a different side of his own creativity. And the fullest version of that is this opera from 1975, pictured here, How Music Can Save the World. It has its own sort of behind-the-scenes story. But since this is Mr. Eisenson's 15 minutes of fame, let's go to one more audio example from this environment. David Eisenson on bass, a drummer, an alto saxophonist, a tenor saxophonist, and the vibes player Carl Berger performing at this engagement at Slugs in 1969. What you'll hear in this case is starting in the middle of the bass solo and then bleeding out into one of the few examples we have of a piece written by David Eisenson. This is track 3. There's a couple of biographical points within Eisenson's next little curvature that have a lot to do with how we lose the trail, how the world sort of loses or somehow will retain the trail of what he's going to do. Not least is that he's disenchanted with music enough to go and do something else. He becomes a psychologist and is part of the FLAP or FLAP approach to identifying one's emotions as a means of psychotherapy. And actually there's a small footprint for that in his tape library as well, as he sort of morphs out of music into paying attention to psychology. Eisenson has two sons ultimately, one now survives. The first one though is his fellow Solomon, who was born with a severe musculature disadvantage such that he needed constant attention, which is another reason to get out of music. He actually needed daily massage from a team of people that Eisenson assembled to do this work. And that sort of engagement with his son was what led to that 1975 opera called How Music Can Save the World. So David Eisenson is basically off the scene of music from the time that he's about 30 or 44 years old, and as it would happen for most of the last 4 or 5 years of his life. The last item here is kind of a quizzical one, I'm sure. When Eisenson's wife died 10 years after him, it was only worth reporting in the New York Times because she, along with David Eisenson, had co-founded this organization called Pot Smokers Anonymous. They did create that together at the end of the 1960s. And because she outlived him by 10 years, she had a lot more to do with the sort of unfurling of it. But among the other footnote credentials for David Eisenson, this is part of the legacy that he leaves us somewhere in his materials as well. Let's talk for a minute about the materials. Some of you will know the name of a person who's more famous than Dave Eisenson, the recordist called Jerry Newman, who ran this sound studio called Stereo Sound Studios. Newman had been an Ivy League graduate operating in New York in the late 30s and was a pioneer of his own dimension of field recording, and had a sort of background role in recording for labels like Savoy through the 1960s. He and David Eisenson are friends, which means a couple of things. One is there's good chances for Eisenson to drop by after hours when the studio's not in use, get favorable rates, and record some stuff. Another one is that it turns out that Jerry Newman kills himself in the top of 1969, and Eisenson was on the scene to sort of help to orient some of the things that were projects ongoing and rescue those materials. And it's going to show up a little bit later in this presentation, but there's also a body of stuff where, in order to get tape to record himself, Eisenson got scrap and excess tape from the Jerry Newman studios, some of which turns out to be quite interesting on its own, though it has no relevance to Dave Eisenson's library. Within what Eisenson retained, not surprisingly, as we all do, he had a bunch of family things going back and forth, sometimes reunions and audio letters and so on. Although in David Eisenson's case, this bottom one is actually written from Pittsburgh to an Eisenson who in 1965 had moved with Ornette Coleman to London. And in the exchange of audio letters, of which we have parts of both ends of it, there actually is useful and unique information about what Eisenson and Ornette Coleman are up to. Home reels of his own practice, a few things from Pittsburgh, and then as exemplified in the bottom here from some sessions from 1967 and 69, bands that didn't make a record that David Eisenson is part of. These are in varying audio quality. Obviously, they're across all five speeds from 15 16ths up to 15 IPS. And a great deal of useful information about some obscure stuff. Speaking of which, this is one of the, it turns out that Eisenson is part of a band in New York in the 60s, to give you one example, called the Uni Trio, that did not make a record. It looks like they're debut on records will be a 50th anniversary thing next year. But this is their only appearance in the supporting role for, let's call him an eccentric character in New York, who's made a 45 of his tributes to John Fitzgerald Kennedy and RFK as well. A little scrap of a foothold for this band on records thus, but there's a great deal more, let's say 8 to 10 hours of what the Uni Trio actually sounded like when they were doing their own music on their own. And then what comes up from the Jerry Newman surplus reel stock is a couple of things that have nothing to do with Dave Eisenson, but are actually unique and important on their own. Film soundtrack, for instance, with Bill Evans and Toots Thielemans. This is an Odetta session reel at the top from one of her, I guess it's not Vanguard, but Elektra records. The session footage stayed with Jerry Newman and then got passed on to Dave Eisenson and somehow is part of his library now, and a number of other things such as the one you see pictured at the bottom. The cornerstone here within Eisenson's collection, one of the main points of interest, is just hundreds of, not hundreds, but nearly 100 recordings of Ornette Coleman in informal circumstances, making music in public, recorded from the stage by Eisenson, or making rehearsal footage for himself. Take note of the bottom line that's written on that tape box. This is Eisenson handwriting saying, if needed, could be erased, talking about an Ornette Coleman rehearsal, and this is why I invite you into considering this matter. There's maybe one circulating rehearsal of Ornette Coleman's music for a fellow whose concept has been so opaque that we've wanted and wanted again and again to dive into how does this music work. It's fascinating to think that there's such a plenitude of it within Dave Eisenson's collection that he thought, oh, I could just re-record over that one and reuse it for something else. In very brief, the collection fell into the hands of one of his students, John Lindberg, who must be saluted because he's been trekking around the world as an itinerant musician on his own, dragging these many kilos of software with him, such that they now exist in a much safer spot where we can actually listen to them and do the cataloging and preservation steps. Likewise, his colleague, Eisenson's colleague, Joe Schiani, and a friend of the widow when she died, who also took another pot of the recordings just as they were about to disappear. Concluding thoughts. The biggest one, and I want to zoom out all the way on this, is to indicate to you the David Eisenson collection as an example of a very large body of hundreds, make it thousands of hours of important footage relating to the documentation of the jazz avant-garde in New York in the critical years in the 60s and the 70s, belongs to the library of several musicians who are Eisenson's contemporaries. Some of them are the designers and framers of the music, like Ornette Coleman, and some of them are sidemen, bringing up other issues to consider. But most of these things, while they're not lost at sea, they're afloat, and they haven't yet come to harbors. It's fascinating to me to come to ARS conferences like this and hear the success stories of yourselves and our colleagues who say, here's what we've done. It's finished, it's safe, it's now being circulated. And much of this history is not yet in that state. And so this is sort of a provocation to consider the matter. In a single sentence, there is room for a champion to rise who wants to be, right, a university or an institution that can do what Cornell is doing, Columbia is doing, UCSC is doing a little bit, could do that in a big way and become the citadel for the critical information in this music. So Eisenson is part of it. There are naturally the issues of on what authority does Dave Eisenson have these things where he's a sideman and how should we deal with it, especially with Ornette Coleman, who's famously litigious in documenting his own stuff and being a jealous guardian of it. And lastly, this last sentence, which is not a major obstacle, but it's a confusing one. The last sentence in the second paragraph, Eisenson tells us, I don't want to record anymore. This is from the late 60s. Because that way I may leave something behind that someone who has a chance to think for himself may hear and still stop thinking for himself. Well, thanks, Dave. He did record a lot, and among other things, it's thought-provoking moments like this that at least help to guide our thinking and understanding of how this collection is important as a resource for understanding virtuosity within free jazz, and I hope we all get a better chance to explore those dimensions by and by. These are some of the people who have helped in the preservation of these materials, and I hope we can add some names to the list and tell the story in full at some point soon. Thank you very much.